Hello and welcome to the Ori Spotlight Podcast. We're talking to leaders across the cell and gene therapy industry and telling you more about Ori's mission to manufacture brighter futures. I'm Jason Foster, the CEO of Ori Biotech, and I'll be your host for today's podcast. Hello and welcome to the Ori Spotlight Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Foster. This week, we are joined by Mike Paglia. Mike is the COO, the Chief Operating Officer of Elevate Bio Basecamp. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you, Jason. Thanks for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Great to have you on today, and great, really excited to hear more about all the exciting things happening at Elevate. So let's just start off, if we can, a little bit more on you, and then we'll get to all those other important topics. But I'd love to hear a little bit more about your journey and how you ended up in the role you're in today.
Sure. Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, it's an exciting place to be in right now, especially in cell and gene therapy. But I started in biotech about 20 years ago, like many others in the therapeutic antibody process development and manufacturing, mm-hmm. Where we worked on a novel anti-CD3, CD4 antibody program at a company called Tolerex. And then shortly after that, I was there for 10 years and moved through to commercial manufacturing. Really great program, great team, learned a lot about drug development. And then after that company, unfortunately, programs failed and the company was closed, had the opportunity to work at Bluebird Bio. So got introduced to Nick and Jeff and the team through a colleague that I worked with at Tolerex and started at Blue real early, really just became excited about the field of cell and gene therapy. It was 30 people at that time, stayed there, was responsible for all drug product as the head of technical operations. So really learned the regulatory environment with an amazing team. And then, kept moving through advanced therapies, did a little bit of oncolytic herpes virus production and manufacturing at a company called Oncorus. Mm-hmm. And then, one of the co-founders of Elevate Bio, Mitch Feiner, introduced me to what was going on to build Elevate. And it was exciting. And, again, having to be able to build teams and including the GMP manufacturing was something that I was passionate about and just welcomed the opportunity. So, overall started in the laboratory process development and then just through increasing levels of responsibility and really understanding the drug development life cycle and being successful at that led me to the operating officer role here at Elevate.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah, no, it sounds like you've, through the course of your career, you've touched the therapy side, touched now the services side, and caught the bug of cell and gene, which many people do when you kind of get into the field. People want to find a way to stay in it, which is great. I'd be interested to hear, maybe for those people that don't know that much about Elevate, it's got a couple parts. So you're the COO of Basecamp, which has a particular set of capabilities, and then Elevate is a bigger, kind of larger institution. For those people that don't know, could you just explain a bit more about the organization, how it, how it operates across its various verticals?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think the vision of the co-founders of the company, who's David Halal, is our CEO, Vikas Sinha is our CSO, and Mitchell Feiner, as I said, is our CSO, was really to do something from the beginning, very purpose-built on the technology, understanding the demand and the need in cell and gene therapy at that time to really build the infrastructure to support not only our own therapeutic companies, but those of partners and clients. So very early on, the way in which the company is structured is Elevate Bio is an LLC, which invests in new technologies. And one of those big investments from the LLC was Elevate Bio Basecamp. So it's the infrastructure, it's the structure that supports process development, GMP manufacturing and innovation. The LLC is also investing in very novel and exciting new technology. We have a company in North Carolina, Life Edit, that's part of our ecosystem that has novel gene editing components. We have an amazing inducible pluripotent stem cell team as well to be able to make ethically derived GMP compliant iPSCs for regenerative medicine products, which we do here at Basecamp. And then therapeutic companies. We also have therapeutic companies that are in clinical trials, clinical development, to be able to advance those through the clinical pipeline, but also obviously to begin to translate those into novel modalities and GMP manufacturing, again, things that we support here at Basecamp. So Basecamp, as you said, is unique where we not only support our portfolio, but we also support partners. You know, we don't have unlimited capacity, but our partners come and they work with us as a manufacturing business. We don't necessarily have to invest in them in any way. It can be just a fee-for-service situation. And they get access to our technology, whether it's our platform, CAR-T processes, TCR processes, lentiviral vector processes, and again, as I said before, our gene editing technology and our iPSCs. So pretty exciting, diverse model, and just an amazing team that we've built here and, again, across the country, really, to support new technologies and therapeutics in the cell and gene therapy field.
Yeah, super exciting. I know a couple of years ago when you and I first met, it was a completely novel setup, the kind of the entrepreneurial from the ground up thinking that, that you guys did and have raised a substantial amount of money to really invest in this new modality, which is hugely exciting. And when we saw each other last, we were at your absolutely beautiful facility that you spent a lot of time and effort building over the last couple of years. But maybe it's worthwhile just speaking to that, the kind of physical footprint that you've put together. I think there's one facility now, but there may be others in the offing, if I remember, just updating the kind of listeners on that.
Yeah, we continue to expand, not only just great staff and but also the infrastructure. So our facility, base camp is what we call it. It's here in Waltham, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. It's 140,000 square feet. It's a pretty amazing building. The building itself is 400,000 square feet. Wow. And some interesting history. It's an old post office distribution center. But the building itself was, as I said, really built for cell and gene therapy collaboration and innovation with our partners. Mm-hmm. So it's not a typical, you know, and you've seen this facility, not a typical manufacturing site. You know, it's very much was built for, you know, to showcase our partners and our innovators and our scientists. And really from the beginning, it was science on display was the mission to be able to showcase what we do here and really get the best talent in the industry to come and work with us. So what we have is we have process development laboratories for both cell and gene therapy, you know, also for supporting our clinical programs and our innovation in immunotherapy and cell engineering and viral engineering. Melissa Carpenter, who is our CSO of our iPSC company, has laboratory space here where her team's working on novel ways to, create and differentiate iPSCs for these regenerative medicine programs. Mm-hmm. And then the GMP manufacturing infrastructure. So we have, very successful GMP manufacturing ongoing at the facility right now. We have cell therapy capacity. We have 6 clean rooms, grade B suites mm-hmm. for the manufacturing of cell therapy products, and as well as viral vector, separate and segregated through air handling and control strategies. We have viral vector capabilities as well for lentiviral vector, adeno, gamma retro. Again, the supporting structure to be able to work with, whether it's allogeneic and autologous, and certainly something that, you know, you guys at Oreo are trying to solve also is to get out of those highly classified environments. Yes. And, you know, unfortunately, right now, a lot of the systems that we translate, whether it's through our platforms or our partners, have open manipulations. Mm-hmm. So we had to, you know, have a grade B environment. So, a very successful meeting with the FDA as well, type C meeting on our segregation and control strategy for a multi-product facility. And then something I'll just touch on lastly, very important, analytics, analytical development capabilities to pre-qualify, validate assays. You know, essentially we have phase 3 programs in the facility right now. So the ability to not only develop, but translate those into quality control release testing. Mm. And, so a highly digital infrastructure from the beginning to manufacture multiple patients in a room at the same time. We have SAP for our ERP solution, mm-hmm. electronic records, if it fits those programs from an MES perspective, and really just state of the art in terms of the facility itself. And then, of course, most importantly, the people. Just an amazing experience in cell and gene therapy from our, you know, the operators on the floor, our CMC regulatory team, process development, and even, you know, our clinical team, apheresis network management, things of that nature through our supply chain. So really end-to-end services for our clients and, you know, our partners.
Yeah, it's an amazing breadth of expertise and under one roof. You don't see that very often. I noticed you didn't use the word CDMO or the letters CDMO because I don't think that's exactly what you guys are. But Where does it begin and end? Give me a kind of typical scenario. Is it a academic spin out that comes to you and says, you know, we need help with this or that kind of, how does it maybe differ from the traditional models that are out there?
Yeah. So it varies. We do have a lot of academic partners. We have amazing collaborations with Mass General Hospital and Boston Children's Hospital, and where we work with teams to be able to help develop those therapies as well as needed. But often, like a perfect example is even a venture capital backed company, mm-hmm. where they really can't build the infrastructure rapidly, the teams to be able to develop these novel therapies rapidly. Mm-hmm. So they often come to work with us with an idea, you know, whether it's a target or a gene of interest, and say, hey, can you help us develop a cell or a gene therapy process? Mm-hmm. And that's where our process development team, you know, kicks in, and they just do an amazing job taking an idea and looking at the tools that we have available at the facility and really designing a process for that product. Mm-hmm. We understand what the clinical trial looks like, the number of patients, the doses, for example, and we can actually design the process for them using our tools and our technology that we have in place. So oftentimes it's an embedded model where they come even to Basecamp. We have one client that comes here for their weekly program meetings because the team feels that time together is really important. Mm-hmm. We're developing that process. We're moving it through, you know, into GMP manufacturing and, you know, anything that supports the regulatory success of those programs. So those are the types of partnerships that we work on as one flavor. And then we have capacity, and we just work with clients that need capacity, whether it's a bridge to their own facility, which they're rethinking, mm-hmm. because we are now building more capacity with partners to be able to say, hey, let's start here and then figure out what you need later for commercial, because we can launch from this facility and let's do it together rather than you make that investment and do it alone. So so we have relationships with just industry partners in the biotech that just use capacity. But as you said, not a CDMO model where we're trying to overbook capacity. We're very thoughtful about the partners that we work with. They have to be very much, you know, it has to be a collaboration more than just a, you know, a service agreement to generate tremendous amounts of revenue. Sure. On a daily basis or something like that. It's going to really be a partnership. And we love those partners that get access to different types of our technology. They'll come to us for one thing, and then we can help them with another, for example. So definitely a unique model, and it's we're seeing a lot of great partnerships coming through the door every day, and we enjoy working with them as if they're our own products as well.
Two elements that you touched on that I think are super interesting. One is this ability or the need to, as you go through the process development phase, as you're designing your processes, to ultimately think about the future. You know, how do we get to scale? How do we create a path so that we can go through the late stage clinical trials and we can ultimately reach a large number of the patient population? And that, let's say, traditionally hasn't necessarily been a primary concern early in the development process, but we have seen it bite many companies on the other side. If they do get some good clinical data and they try and find a process that can work at scale, that translation often is extremely difficult. So how do you guys try and future-proof this for clients and ensure that the work that you're doing at small scale, preclinical or early stage clinical, can actually take them, you know, through the process to commercial?
Yeah, it's a great topic for discussion. We could spend an hour just talking about that alone. It is key, and we see that from, you know, whether it's young biotech or companies just getting into cell and gene therapy. Mm. Great science, great idea, great therapeutic, novel, really transformative for the patient, but not understanding the development landscape or the regulatory environment. So what we do very early on is we have a really robust sort of onboarding and tech transfer, so to speak, methodology where it comes into our group and really starting with the raw material risk assessment, mm-hmm. understanding what those raw material requirements are, because that's, as you know, where companies often do run into trouble is because they've selected the wrong raw material. And then, as you said, accelerated approval, and then they go ex-US and understand that they can't use that component anywhere else in the world. So costly comparability. So the knowledge that we have internally, having gone through approved products before, the team here has worked on several products that are now approved therapies in cell and gene therapy. So understanding that environment and what to select early is important, but also the tools, the devices that we use, whether it's in cell or gene therapy. As you said, it's hard to future-proof, but making sure that whatever we choose can scale with the industry. There's a lot of exciting new technology that comes online every day from, you know, cell processing to viral vector. So we've taken a very modular approach to our processes where we can expand and feel confident in a very robust comparability strategy. As the industry advances, we can now take that unit operation and replace it with something else without really having to worry about costly comparability. So versus, you know, necessarily always being working with raw materials that are unique or devices that are necessarily maybe not solving the challenge of some of the products or the doses. So, you know, we know the industry is expanding and we're excited about that. And especially on the technology side, to make sure that we can pivot and really, like you say, try to be future-proof as much as possible.
And we've seen, let's call it a micro trend of therapy developers who I think initially wanted to build out their capacity earlier in their life cycle, invest in the footprint, you know, own that capacity. Many of those that sort of did that initially are starting to maybe rethink that strategy and moving away from, you know, really heavy investments in infrastructure and thinking about a different, you know, more flexible approach. I wonder if you know, what your thinking is on that. What are the driving forces behind that? I have my own view, of course. You know, I think the challenge, as you well know, having built a facility, is it's a massive resource drain, you know, both financial and human resource to build a facility, to build it properly. But for a lot of therapy developers, it's a huge risk because they don't know when or if they're going to need that much capacity in that place. You know, you're sort of taking a bet on your regulatory approval timeline and ultimately market launch timeline, market access. There's a lot of unknowns to try and do this well ahead of time. So do you see a trend maybe swinging backward more towards a shared resource like a base camp for those early stage developers that then de-risk the program a bit more before they move into their own facilities, or maybe they never move?
Yeah, we are. Yeah, we're definitely seeing more companies come to us that had plans to build their own capacity. But understanding, as you said, building is hard enough, you know, getting it right the first time from a design perspective, but then operating and covering the cost of a facility, especially for these advanced therapies, until we can get to devices that are completely closed system that you can run in lower classifications, the cost of running cell therapy programs and the staff is expensive. And, you know, to run those programs on your own is quite difficult. So having an infrastructure here like we have at Basecamp where companies can work with us but not have to build that infrastructure is very attractive to them. And, you know, again, making sure there's, for us, that personalized approach where we very high touch with the clients and the partners to make sure we satisfy what they need, but also that we work in collaboration together. So we are seeing that, and there's evidence of that in the industry where you see it every day, where existing GMP capacity for cell or gene therapy is getting bought out by whether it's a CDMO or a larger pharmaceutical company to be able to not only acquire technology, but also just capacity. So, but we're expanding. So we see certain things in the industry and we're trying to take advantage of that now because we can help de-risk those programs and expand and scale because we do have clients and we do have partners in our own therapeutics that can fill that capacity. We can help de-risk some of those facilities. And those are kind of ongoing conversations that we like to have.
Would the intent ever be, do you think, to be able to manufacture at a commercial scale? Or is there some logical point where kind of a base camp set of suite of support doesn't move beyond in your mind?
Yeah, I mean, the facility here, like, again, we've built it for pretty, you know, a large capacity for autologous cell therapy and really ample capacity for an allogeneic cell program. So again, the phase three programs and the phase three readiness, the systems that we built can certainly support launch. And it just becomes the indication. The clean rooms here are not designed for thousands of patients, but the plan would be as we work with those companies, we know how to build those facilities as well and operate them. So understand the timeline to when they think they will need those 5,000 to 10,000 patients per year. We've actually gone through the effort of already designing facilities that support that type of throughput. So we're ready to expand rapidly with the clients and to be able to also take the systems that we've built here at Basecamp. They're very transportable, and that's why we did that. That's why early we spent the investment on an ERP solution that's scalable, electronic records. So commercially, we can expand with the clients very rapidly with our quality systems, the tools that we have, and the know-how. But right now, you know, we could satisfy commercial allogeneic type programs here. And autologous, we're, as I said, ready to go and expand. And same for the viral vectors to some extent.
Sure.
Yeah.
No, it's a super exciting model. I think the innovation that you're bringing into the field and the ability, you know, we're really, one of the words we use most frequently is flexibility. We're trying to give therapy developers flexibility to make decisions when the risk reward balance is right. It's in their favor. And I think, you know, from what you've said, it sounds a lot of what you're doing is kind of de-risking some of that upfront. You know, we can learn some of the lessons we need to learn before we need to make, you know, massive investments in infrastructure as a therapy developer, which makes a ton of sense to me. As you look to expansion, you know, we've talked to some other individuals on the podcast who felt very strongly that having a kind of a larger geographic footprint was a benefit. What's your feeling on, you know, as we move again to later stage programs or trying to deliver larger number of patients, is something kind of a more of a network approach in your mind, a direction of travel that makes sense? Or is there a benefit to sort of a concentration of footprint in one place? Is it kind of six one half dozen the other? I'm curious. I know it's traditionally it was more the latter in traditional pharma, but I wonder how you see that evolving for cell and gene.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends on the therapy itself. Like, I mean, obviously having that localized presence or a centralized, it very much matters on the product. And I think as we develop these processes and make sure they can actually be deployed from anywhere, that's the key. And some of them still can't be. So having this large footprint in one area makes sense for some products and some therapies. But then, you know, having geographically, strategically in these locations is also important. I think what we like to do also is look where the innovation is happening and try to centralize capacity or capability in those areas. There's amazing work coming out of almost every university in the country, in the U.S. and outside the U.S. So making sure that those folks have the ability to be able to scale when they partner, whether it's through a grant or some funding, or they, you know, essentially diversify the asset and sell it to a biotech company that we're there to really help them and expand. So it depends really on the product in my mind. And I think both strategies can satisfy a multitude of products. You know, our philosophy is to go where the need is, and certainly not just not to, you know, canvas and the entire world. It's really to understand where the need is and where we can support those programs through our technology. You know, I think you can kind of guess of where we're looking, but it's really around the innovation that we'll use, you know, things like our iPSC lines, our gene editing, and then of course our platforms for the manufacturing and process development. But we like to be around that innovation.
Yeah. You know? Well, there's certainly plenty of innovation happening in Boston.
It is. It's so exciting. It's amazing. Yeah, it's a good spot.
more to keep you busy for decades, if not longer. But mentioned earlier something that's a super interesting topic I'd like to explore a bit more, which is around your digital platform that underpins the work that you do and the facility. I think, you know, one of the shorthands we started to use quite a lot internally is, you know, paper is the enemy of scale. You know, this kind of idea that we're manually batch releasing, you know, using paper batch records, you know, it's maybe okay in the preclinical or, you know, clinical phase, but definitely doesn't work at scale. And so the fact that you've invested in that digital infrastructure already is really interesting. You know, ERP, you mentioned MES systems. What's your view on this? I mean, I think the ability to capture data in real time to understand what's happening in your process at a higher level, you talked about analytics. It's one of the things that's tripped the industry up quite a lot. I see it as a huge advantage being kind of paperless, being digital first. But I'm curious, you know, what made you take the step to invest in that, you know, ahead of time?
Yeah, it was truly exactly that, knowing that we had to scale rapidly and having gone through these programs before and how quickly they get approved and go into commercial and then trying to stumble and, you know, scale for commercial manufacturing through a paper-based system. So, I mean, we're not as, you know, bold to say there's no printers in the facility like some companies have, which is an interesting concept. But, you know, to go digital from the beginning was a big decision for, you know, when we were only probably 6 to 8 people in the company. Yeah. So as you can imagine, rolling out an ERP solution with so few staff was quite a heavy lift. But we've had tremendous advantage of having that now.
Yeah.
As a company, and the facility exceeds almost 200 people. And truly, you know, being able to track and trace and get data from the shop floor, we have a very focused effort, even in our IT department. We actually have functions in the IT department that are dedicated to Industry 4.0 initiatives, machine learning. We just actually had some meetings this week about next steps on. We went through a very thoughtful Industry 4.0 gap assessment. And, you know, the companies that we worked with said, you know, Elevate Bio has everything. They have the systems in place to enable 4.0. And now the integration of those systems that we are working on really help empower us and empower our partners to get access to that data real time to help make informed decisions about new process development and what makes sense. And we like to even take it a step further where we tie it to, you know, preclinical and even clinical data if possible. Obviously, there's sensitivities around there, and we don't necessarily have that ability through partners, but our own therapeutics. But really making, you know, how those cells are expanding in vivo for some programs to how they're growing out in the cell culture during a GMP run, for example. So all of that data, you know, we're collecting it now and really using some pretty exciting ways to integrate it and understand it. But everything in the facility, as I said, you know, whether it's through our electronic batch records or our notebooking systems and the way in which we deploy and analyze that, you know, we have a team, and we think it's very important. And if you're not doing it, I think you don't have the ability to manufacture at the capacity we do, really help to improve a process rapidly. It's a lot of data, but it's a lot of great data that folks, there's new tools. You know, the DOE studies that we do, it actually accelerates development having these systems in place. And really, we cut short that development timeline for clients because we can rapidly make decisions on product improvements.
It's awesome to hear you say that, because I think, you know, we talk about the three legs that were restooled, the biology, the engineering and automation, and the data platform. It's exactly that benefit that we try and articulate, not only from a, let's say, a quality or a QC perspective, but if you're in PD, it just gives you an extra layer of understanding of what's happening in your process and helps you shortcut things that would normally take a long time to understand. It helps you identify areas of potential variation that you want to try and eliminate. You know, just these things that I think today the black box that has been manufacturing that's really vexed the industry. You know, we see results that we can't explain. You know, we try and create causal relationships or identify causal relationships is extremely difficult. And being able to have the kind of systems that you've just articulated, it's a stepwise process. You have to go from let's capture the data and let's structure it in a way that makes sense. And let's, you know, make sure that, you know, we can actually do something with it. And then the overlay that you articulated, which was a great one, which is the analytics piece. How do we turn that data into information? For ourselves, for your partners, none of those tools really are available today. It's almost starting from scratch. And when you look at, you know, Amazon Web Services and other big companies that drive these kinds of, you know, multivariate analysis or machine learning algorithms, they exist almost in every other field besides ours.
Right.
So I'm curious what the reaction is. Do people look like you have a third eye when you start talking about these things, or
they get nervous?
Yeah.
Right. They're like, oh boy, like how does this? I'm like, it's actually a benefit. Mm. You know, again, we take almost an approval approach to development, but it's not slowing things down. But if you don't, as you said, do some level of process characterization on a product, almost as if you're moving right into a PPQ run, you're going to be in big trouble even during clinical manufacturing. So the ability to generate those samples, again, the people that know how to do it have gone through these approval processes before, take that data and then, you know, lock in a process. It's much more robust and less risk when you move into GMP manufacturing. So it actually saves time later. it'll save on, hopefully failures in GMP or any excursions that you may see in the GMP environment. So people get nervous. I think what we see is they get nervous when they hear electronic batch record. And, you know, a fully validated electronic record is not for every product. There are some that you still, you know, again, we don't have necessarily paper, but there's digital solutions. You know, we call them paper on glass, right? But you can still collect the data. But a fully validated electronic record has a lot of benefits for the right process. So when, you know, that's an education for newer companies that haven't looked at an electronic batch record before. It's different. It's not a paper system and you can't just go line by line and did they witness, did they, you know, it's a new way to look at data. And what we're moving towards, you know, this year is to review by exception, where that system's validated. There's a training in place. Everyone's trained, and any exception gets highlighted, and that's what you review because then you know that everything else, those steps are validated.
Yes.
And we've gone through processes now with electronic records and shown that that works quite well. So now you can start to reduce on staff costs, suite time, review time, and frankly, the most important thing, getting that product back to the patient as rapidly as possible.
Yeah.
So that's our goal, and that's why we've built those systems. Again, always with that, you know, we took the, you know, worst case, so to speak, autologous program in mind when we've built our systems and our facility to be able to support something like that. And then allogeneic just benefits from it as well.
Sure. Yeah. Well, the audience heard it here first. Mike Bagley said investing in digital systems up front pays huge dividends in the back end, which
it is a bit of a headache, but it's definitely worth the investment.
Wholeheartedly agree. But I think it goes back to the point we were talking about earlier, which is the decisions we make early in the process sometimes come back to bite us. And so, you know, we want to try and de-risk as much as we can that pathway to, you know, ultimately, I've said this before on the podcast. So I haven't ever talked to a single PI who said, well, I don't really care if my product ever helps patients. Every single one of them, their goal is to get it into the clinic and get it to as many patients as possible if it's effective. But some of those decisions we make early on, unfortunately, end up being barriers to that rather than promoters of that. And so this is a big one where our chief data officer, Kevin Gordon's putting together some of the other leaders in the space, and I will definitely have him reach out to you to try and formulate
absolutely
kind of a best of breed opinion. Like, this is what good looks like from a paperless manufacturing perspective. This is why it's important that we agree ahead of time. This is, you know, the benefits it can have. And ultimately, I think the idea that paper is the enemy of scale, if the endpoint that I think is most important, which is how many patients get successfully treated with these therapies, that's the measuring stick that matters. If we believe that to be the case, this kind of investment becomes a no-brainer. If it's, can we just get into the clinic so we can, you know, raise a big Series A or some of those other milestones that are important, but maybe not the end game. I think sometimes we lose sight of the big picture, or it becomes less important, unfortunately. So very excited to hear you guys share that view.
Yeah, same with you guys. We, you know, what you guys are doing at Ori right now on the digitization end of things is pioneering. So that's exciting, and love to partner with everyone on that. So, you know, I think that's a general topic that we hear a lot about, is how can the industry in general benefit from some of the innovations like companies like Ori or Elevate and what we're doing. So consortiums and getting together and having these conversations and being open about it, I think, is key. So that's a really good point.
Definitely. To that point, take that point a little bit further. There's, you know, we've talked a lot about new innovations that are coming into the field and the business models and the way we approach, you know, program development, et cetera. What is your thought? I mean, one of the things that concerns me is that we haven't really seen much commercial success. And when I say commercial, meaning we've been able to treat a lot of patients yet, and that kind of the ROI that therapy developers who've invested billions of dollars in developing these products hasn't really been seen yet. And we've, you know, there's been some very public struggles out there, you know, right. your former employer Bluebird in Europe being one. You know, what is needed to get to that inflection point where we're starting to say, you know, there's a new model that's required. You know, I think what's my perception of the situation is that many of us who grew up in small molecules or biologics, you know, we've been doing it a certain way for 20 or 30 years. We know this has worked for us and we really want it to work again, but it just continues to let us down. When do we say, you know what, maybe a new model is required, you know, particularly in that autologous format that you were mentioning is a little bit more difficult, presents a little bit more challenges in a circular supply chain. What do you think are the characteristics of the new model that might evolve for cell and gene therapy that we need to really be carefully considering?
Yeah, it's certainly access, right? So making sure that we can make these processes and these products accessible to the patients, and that, you know, I'm not sort of the right person to ask from a payer perspective, but the reimbursement certainly is a big part of that. And, you know, it always comes down, unfortunately, to cost of goods and reduction and efficiencies. So, you know, the ability to reduce cost of goods so it can get passed along. And I mean, that's what the majority of the conferences we go to, right, are talking about, is how to reduce cost of goods. So then, you know, in turn, the cost of the product goes down and then people will use it. I think some of these transformative ones, though, what we're seeing in the world generally is cell and gene therapy is still not really known. And it's, you know, we talk about it every day here at Basecamp, where, you know, we identify the patients and we're trying to help. And we hear stories, unfortunately, within our four walls of friends, family that suffer through cancers. And some of these are like, wow, I wonder why they didn't do a cell or gene therapy trial. We know that one actually in that specific cancer could help them. And it's also, you know, I think that education that these programs and these products actually are transforming and are becoming curative potentially. So it's a hard question to answer. I mean, the easy answer is cost of goods, reducing them, getting more access, and that is a big part of it. But I think it's just a global sort of understanding of what cell and gene therapy can help. You know, I've had family members that have gone on these trials and these early phase clinical trials, and there's a lot of them out there, yeah. Right? And it's hard to understand which one's the right one, especially, you know, what's, you know, academic site or what doctor is promoting them and really pioneering these types of therapies. So it's something that I think we'd like to see in the field is, let's take the headache away of the cost and let's take that barrier away. And now let's try to pivot to making people understand that they can get access to it. And these could be transformative. So especially for the monogenetic disorders, having gone through seeing that, it's very powerful. It's very inspiring to work on programs like we did at Blue and like we do here at Elevate, mm-hmm. to see the immediate cure, so to speak, on these folks where if they didn't have that transplant or that treatment, you know, they would die. Like adrenal leukodystrophy is the perfect example where the X-linked disorder, where if those boys didn't get those treatment, there's really no hope within 6 months. So it's very powerful. And when you're at the receiving end of that as a family member or a parent, it you know, the word starts to spread around that, hey, wow, gene therapy can really help people and save lives, which is something, again, we try to do here at Elevate as well, getting you know, locally out there, let people know what we do, because I think in overall that'll help the industry to get these products to patients as well.
For sure. You touched on a super important point around cost of goods. And when I often talk about this issue, people say, well, prices and cost of goods aren't necessarily linked. And you say, well, it stands to reason that if we are able to lower cost of goods, it gives therapy developers flexibility to be innovative in the way they contract and provide their products to the market. What do you think are the biggest opportunities for savings on the cost of goods side? I mean, when you look at the breakdown of what it costs to develop a product, viral vector is often called out as a very expensive input. And a lot of it tends to be labor. And so obviously the way we think about this being an enabling technology platform, we're hoping to take a lot of that labor cost out. We're hoping to be more efficient, you know, potentially having, you know, lower level, lower skilled labor required if there's any left in the system, using less of various expensive inputs like vector or others. Like, how do we look for efficiencies? What's the low-hanging fruit from your perspective? Where do you see the efficiencies to be gained the most quickly?
Yeah, I think something we touched on earlier as well is the technology and the automation, even that component alone, to be able to start to think about ways in which we can go faster and with less staff. You're right, it's the overhead, it's the cost of the infrastructure, the people, the classifications of the rooms that's needed for some of these programs. So thinking about, you know, opportunities, it's innovation on new therapeutic, you know, modalities for transformation of these cells, for genetic modification of these cells, and doing it faster, you know, and less hands-on time. The analytics is still, I keep going back to that, but even the ability to release these products in different ways and more rapidly, you know, getting data to, and the FDA has said this, you know, for many, many years, where show us the data, you know, and then we can make a decision together. But there's extensive release testing. It's not just GMP manufacturing time, right? And suite time. It's the release testing and the time it takes to do all of the release of these products as well from a safety perspective. So if we can start to think about, you know, it's hard to say quality by design for some of these products, but thinking about building the quality into the process, where almost the in-process monitoring and the in-process testing defines that that product is safe and it's going to be efficacious, and sort of reduce the back end time on the release testing and the staff costs there. I think that's also a big opportunity for advancement. So we work on, spend a lot of time on optimizing assays, reducing time for testing, but also the in-process testing and making sure that we have access to that data from the devices almost real time is really, I think, some opportunities in the industry to reduce those costs. But I think you're spot on. It's really, you know, just overall staff cost and touch of a product and time that'll help to reduce that as well.
You touched on that briefly there, but I'd like to explore it maybe just a little bit further. And, you know, what are the innovations that make you say, wow, like things that you're really excited about that you've sort of maybe heard whispers of, that, you know, things that are coming to market on the technology side? It might be automation. It might be, you know, new other, maybe it's transfection technologies, could be any number of things. What are the things that you're really excited about that are upcoming over the next couple of years that you can't wait to get your hands on?
Yeah, no, that's why we built a group that's focused on that. We have an innovation department. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a process development department that goes from PD to GMP, but we also have a department that's working to look at new process innovations. And it's across the board, as you said, Jason. It's not just devices. It's ways to, you know, transfect, transduce cells, to grow cells, to activate cells. Mm-hmm. Really, there's a lot of exciting technology. What I'm most excited about are companies taking cell and gene therapy seriously now. Mm. And really purpose-built devices for cell and gene therapy. I mean, you know this well, you know, from the time when we were, you know, started at Blue, we, you know, our team repurposed blood salvage devices. Yeah. And to be able to do some of this large cell processing and manipulation of these cells. So now, like, the tools that are coming out in the industry from many people and many technology companies is really exciting, because they're thinking about the solving the problem that we just talked about, you know, from a personnel perspective, a consistency perspective, and really designing these the right way from the beginning. Mm-hmm. So that stuff, I'm a process guy, you know, my biochemist by training, upstream, downstream, and cell processing. So I'm excited about devices. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, I think why, you know, again, Mitch, David, and Vikas are visionary. They can see what we need next. So understanding what we have at Life Edit and gene editing is really exciting to us as well. Mm-hmm. iPSCs and the regenerative medicine products themselves are just amazing. And there's a long way to go with those as well. Sure. From a manufacturing perspective. The cell lines are hard enough to make, and we know that firsthand, and we've been successful. But now the next step to regenerative medicine products themselves, and that's a whole new world of understanding different modalities and how to make those products a reality for patients is the next challenge. So any technology that tries to solve that is what excites us. And we have, you know, our head of our process innovation group, she has a list of 50 things that she wants to work on, and we meet on a regular basis of like, yeah, this one is going to the top, and we collaborate and work on these programs. So a lot of exciting technology. And then, you know, the analytics, yeah. Higher throughput ways. And, you know, our head of quality, Josh Sorfine, he's really, you know, made a lot of effort into promoting and having the teams develop these assays so they're amenable for high throughput. You know, smaller plate formats, you know, 96 well to 384, 386 well, mm-hmm. formats, to be able to have a higher throughput for some of these automation tools that are coming through development cycles.
Right.
So, yeah, it's a long answer for what excites me, but I think, you know, a lot of it does, to be honest, because it's just exciting that, like I said, companies are really focused on purpose-built technology for these therapies now. Yeah,
no, I think it reflects the how much innovation and is needed, but also the kind of exciting things that are happening. I would have said the same. It's sort of, you know, what really got me excited about the Ori story was, you know, building a platform bespoke up from the ground up for cell and gene therapy. And that, you know, rather than trying to repurpose old tools or refashion things that weren't really intended for its use, being able to design it with this purpose in mind. And if you'd asked me the question, I would have said exactly the same around analytics. You know, the ability to, you know, data is nice. We talked about, you know, the value of it, but data is just noise unless you can make sense of it. You know, and, yeah, you know, there's a lot of sort of, excuse my French, crap data in the system. It's not really telling us anything, you know, but if we could have better, particularly inline capabilities, because we're thinking about scale and scaling with things that are offline or even at line, you know, where you have a device kind of sitting next door, it just interrupts your workflow. And, you know, I think we need better sensor technology. We need better visualization technology, you know, even getting inside the bioreactor, being able to characterize cells, being able to count cells. So if there's any innovators listening out there, I think Mike and I agree that, you know, investing in analytics, new technologies, on those fronts would be a huge benefit. And there's great benefit for the industry, but also a huge demand, I would anticipate, of better analytical technologies coming to market. I hope I didn't put too many words in your mouth, Mike.
No, it's exactly, you know, it's 100% right. I think the, you know, our teams are amazing and they would analyze hundreds of thousands of samples if we had the throughput.
Yeah.
So, and we're expanding that. I mean, that's how important it is to us. I mean, we have Basecamp here and we actually just are expanding down the road here in Waltham, you know, a larger footprint to be able to expand that analytical infrastructure. We're thinking about a big play and being able to help the industry actually because of what we've built here. Mm-hmm. We get a lot of questions and queries about, hey, can you help us with our analytical development? And, you know, actually, yeah, we can. Mm. We have the team that knows how to develop these potency assays. But again, to format them so they're scalable, I think that's the challenge. And you've seen this in the industry as well. Yeah. There's limited now the testing becomes the bottleneck.
Exactly.
So, you know, we see that in our own hands and we're trying to solve that for our partners as well.
Yeah. Once we do the test, we got to make sense of them and then apply that apply that knowledge somehow. So awesome. Yeah. Well, we're coming to the end of our time together, and thank you again so much for spending an hour with me. I'd love to kind of finish on a final view to say, if you were to kind of picture what good looks like in, let's say, a 5-year time frame. I always ask this question to every guest, and it's always a little bit different. So forgive me, but I just wanted ask you just kind of what does good look like from your perspective, 5 years away, maybe even 10 years away? Where will the industry be? What does success look like from your perspective? And what do we need to do, you know, to get there? What's the advice that you'd give to either companies, investigators, people early in their career? You know, we talk a lot about the talent deficit. There's a huge need for, you know, human resources out there. And, you know, if there's anyone out there in their undergrad interested in this field, it's a great place to focus. But if you focus out on that kind of 5 to 10 year horizon, what does success look like for you and how do we get there?
Yeah. You know, I think about what, you know, coming from the world of well-characterized biologics, as many of us have, and there's a lot of competition in the industry in cell and gene therapy now. A lot of this is ours, this is mine. and having the regulatory exposure that I've had through my career, and going, you know, traveling throughout the world, talking to these regulators about how to get these novel products approved has been just eye-opening and exciting. Mm-hmm. So I think the next 5 to 10 years, there needs to be more harmonization in the industry so we can help each other. So whether it's through models like ours, where we work with partners and be able to impress upon them that knowledge that we've had, that experience, to make sure they get it right the first time, or even, you know, service providers or companies that provide quality materials, making sure that it's truly designed to satisfy and help the industry. Mm. You know, again, GMP, you can ask 10 different companies and you may get 10 different answers, but there's one GMP, you know, and making sure the quality of what we all do has this high standard, but more importantly, it's harmonized and we're on the same page.
Yeah.
We see it all the time as well, even things like controls or standards. Everybody uses something different and everyone's comparing this to that, and in the methods, the devices, it's so diverse. So, you know, starting with some type of harmonization on controls and strategies. I mean, the agency just released this week some guidances and on CAR T therapies, you know, or you know, publications where the industry comes together.
Yep.
I think is very important. Like the ISPE has great initiatives, CIRM, all of these documents that come out of the PDA. I think I'm a big fan of education and educating the young investigators on what right looks like.
Yeah.
So they know in 5 years, you know, what they need to potentially do to be able to get those products to the patients faster. So again, education for me, harmonization, some level of, you know, control around what the industry is doing, but that we can all work together to get there is something I'd like to see. And I think is important in the industry.
No, it's a great wish list. I think, you know, we talk about our ecosystem approach often, trying to partner with the best of breed providers. You know, we're not going to do what you do, and we want to help, you know, we want to enable that. And the way I see it, I mean, I just thought of this analogy on the fly, it might be absolutely terrible, but thinking about, you know, if you're playing a football game, you know, before you start competing, you decide the rules, right? You decide, okay, it's 10 yards first down, and, you know, you can only have one forward pass. And there's certain fundamental rules that we agree on before we go and sort of beat the heck out of each other. You know, it's sort of that, where let's get together, let's decide the rules. What does good look like? Let's not keep reinventing the wheel. Let's not keep, you know, learning the same lessons in this, you know, let's call it a pre-competitive context, to say, let's, you know, let's decide the rules. And then that'll make it that much easier for us to achieve that 5 to 10 year vision, if we all can agree what good looks like and what are the rules for getting there. So I love that. That thought.
I like that analogy. I like that one.
Thanks. Okay. It was on the fly, so you never know.
I like it. No, it's a good one.
But I think it's a great idea, and it's a great way to finish, just to say, you know, let's collaborate. Let's figure out a way. We're all trying to work towards the same end, which is let's get as many patients treated as we can. And so let's find a new way to do that. So a big thank you to you, Mike, for coming on to the podcast and for spending an hour with us.
Jason, my pleasure. It was great. No, I really appreciate it. And, you know, again, the opportunity to talk with you, this was great and a lot of fun, actually. So I enjoyed it.
Look forward to seeing you hopefully in Three Dimensions soon. And I'll be in Boston, I'm sure. And you guys are having much nicer weather than we are. So I'll come over and enjoy some of that.
We'll sit up. That's it. We'll sit outside this time. So great.
That sounds excellent. All right. Say hi to Don and the rest of the team. Look forward to seeing you guys soon.
I will. Thank you, Jason. Thanks again.
Thank you for listening to the Ori Spotlight podcast. To keep up with the latest in cell and gene therapy and to follow us on our mission to manufacture brighter futures for patients, head to the show notes to follow us on social media or visit OriBiotech.com.